Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Nicholas D'Cusa, an ongoing podcast. This is episode 2 going through, where I read the various his various works. Nicholas D'Cusa, a very famous seminal thinker. He's what I call a transition thinker, a thinker between various worlds. Modern parlance, he shooketh it. He was shooketh by things. Things really shook his worldview. And so we'll read through this. Episode 1, we looked at where he came, all the amazing things that he produced, and how he's influenced. And his world, you know, the way I view, was set off. He was set off in a slightly different path by discovering that his world was based on a forgery. That's my view. And before you romanticize him, if you really go into it, he's a contradictory character as seen through the lens of modern eyes. He mucks up things that we would never do, philosophy and theology or theology and maths. It's all mucked up. That's part of the view. But also his views are slightly mucked up in terms of the idea of a layman. I think he was actively prosecuted, supported capital punishment. I read somewhere this doesn't stack up with a man we want to love. It's not a man that we idolize. But fortunately, we're in an academic world and we're just looking through this man as his own merits, but not saying he's good or bad. He's had his influence. It's not whether he had an influence. This body of thought came together, but he is a standalone inspiration. Nicholas D'Cusa may arguably be best understood by as employing a Christian Neoplatonic framework to construct his own synthesis of inherited ideas. Well, it's almost a tautology. Neoplatonic. So Plato, sort of one of his visions was that everything is God, derived from God, and speaks back to God. We'll hear about it. And he had these other ideas. And the great thing is that he inherited ideas rather than mechanically derived the idea off the latest stack of progressively scholastic ideas. And of course, scholastic ideas have sort of a low grade quality control. They've got a quality control by looking at the quality stamp rather than actually thinking through. That's my view. And obviously, this is what you have to ask. You read some of the scholastic works, Summa Theologica. There's some there which some arguments are good, but there are some arguments about mystical views are mixed in together because it's a different quality system they have there. His thought witnessed to his own reading a variety of predecessors while sidestepping the methods of the medieval scholastic Summa Theologica, and their typical controversies and arguments. So basically they'd have two contradictory things which are true and say, well, that's my thought process has to move because God is great. Trained as a canon lawyer, Nicholas is mostly self-taught in theology and philosophy. And what I like is lawyers have to, whatever they're assigned to, is apply methods into a new thing. Both his ideas in language may present some difficulties to contemporary readers. His thoughts has to be viewed as a whole, for it works more by correspondences and parallels between domains in his interested in expounding than in a linear fashion or by direct argument, which is basically a transdisciplinary, what we call nowadays, a transdisciplinary negotiator. There you go. That's what we call him now. What is noteworthy are the flexible metaphors he used as he moved across what we designate today as ontology. I don't know what that is. Philosophy of the mind, epistemology, philosophy, theology. His metaphors provide some methodological clue to understanding how Nicholas proposes that we should think God and his creatures together. It's not just God exceeds our conceptual reach and grasp as well as our literal language. The asymmetry between God and creatures also provides a measure or norm for the appropriateness of any metaphor exploring or attempting to explain their relationships. He was looking at the metaphor it's strange. He was looking at a metaphor. He was looking at the error of the metaphor as grasping the truth of things. It's pretty profound. I like him. It's the, basically what you've got to do in your daily life. You say, okay, that's my belief. What does the consequences of my belief? So that, therefore, that's unpanelable. That's good. That's so I can say, perhaps I've got to revise my belief. It's sort of this feedback system. I sort of really like it. 2.1 metaphysics and ontology. So I don't know what ontology is. I do know what metaphysics is. That's the method of thinking. Nicholas de Cusa's most complete set of proposals about the real, what is real, occurs in his best-known work of 1440, De Docta Ignorati, or On Learned Ignorance, which is the foundation thing of science. That is, why are you researching? Well, I don't know everything, fundamentally. Here, Cusanus addresses the four categorical reality is traditionally found in Christian thought: God, the natural universe, Christ, and human beings. On Learned Ignorance devotes its first book, there's four books on it, to God, the second to the universe, the third to God, man, and Jesus Christ. Oh, humans miss out, so there's not a fourth book. While its order mirrors the outflow from God and return to him, this book does not distinguish philosophy and theology as contemporary thinkers might, but unites them in a single overview of Neoplatonic Christianity reality. Yeah, it's important that the view is here, it's sort of a contradiction, this view is that there is absolute reality, whereas Plato mightn't say that. Nicholas begins with a single trope or symbol to lay out the parallels between his teaching in the three books. That is the maximum. God is the absolute maximum. The universe is created as an image of God, the contracted or restricted maximum. Christ unites the first two as the maximum at once, absolute and contracted. The contraction is a metaphor for the finite status of creatures, all of whom are limited images of God. Okay, everything is God. Get into your head, everything is God, God's absolute, and we're sort of contract versions of gods. And that's really interesting. Absolute is used as an etymological sense of free form, absolutus, so that's without a solution, to characterize absolute, to characterize God's infinity. An absolute maximum God is unlimited and transcendent, unreachable by human conceptions that measure the limited or contracted realm of more or less. Once Cusanus conceptualized human knowledge but as measuring, he... So this is really interesting, because this follows the Greek maths cults, the infinity cults, the number cults. This is, once you begin to think numbers, you go, what, can't count them all? What if there's an infinite number of planets? Proposes that our knowledge also cannot measure exactly the essence of any limited thing. Now, this is interesting. A fortiori, when it comes to the unlimited God, Nicholas asserts there is no proportion between finite and infinite. The infinite God remains beyond our ken. Human efforts to understand the depth and implications of this assertion are what he will render our ignorance, our learned ed. As often in Christian thinking, this sort of a phatic preamble does not prevent Cusanus from spending a whole book proposing how we might comprehend the incomprehensible God, incomprehensibility. So we can't comprehend him, but we can comprehend that we cannot comprehend him. It's pretty amazing. His first proposal is God is a coincidence of opposites. This turns out to be a way of recalling the negative theology found in Dionysus of the Areopagite and its other predecessors, and at the same time going beyond it. Put in the language of maximum, God is both maximum and minimum coincide in the divine infinite of oneness, for both take the mind beyond the measurable, create the dominance of more or less, and end up meaning just superlative or transcendent. The implication, in other words, is God's reality lies beyond any familiar domain where the principle of contradiction holds sway. So let's go. I do like the opposites, and it is really something that you really, that third level that you have to go to, the what is, what's not, the relationship between it, and possibly a fourth thing, the consequence of that relationship. I'd go to four levels in my thinking, but he goes to three. At the same time, this coincidence underlines the divine. At the same time, this coincidence underlines the divine oneness that comprehends all these undifferentiated and unlimited unity. It's not that creatures coincide with God or God with creatures, but God, in God, all else coincides with nothing else than God. As so often in negative aphyletic theology, we are not told what God is, but led to reflect explicitly on what God must be, even if we have no conceptual clarity about what we assert. The result is a kind of second-order language about the ways in which we are forced to think and talk about divinity. So this is pretty amazing stuff in terms of that he has got on to the metaphor. Okay, put the metaphor aside. We know it doesn't work. Let's work out the implication of it not working. It's pretty phenomenal stuff. Nicholas then proposes some geometrical exercises to provide his readers some object lessons designed to teach how we might reach the unlimited, even while we are aware we cannot grasp what an infinite God may be. For instance, we are to imagine a circle and a straight line or tangent that meets a circle. From a certain perspective, as the diameter and circumference of the circle increases, its circumference approaches the straight line and appears less and less curved. If we then imagine and extrapolate the circumference to the infinite, we can almost see that both straight line and straight tangent and curved circumference should coincide, a kind of coincidence of opposite. That is a figure of how we might think beyond the limited things towards the transcendent one, capital O, one, that's God. All this is mathematically impossible, of course, but it demonstrates some metaphorical steps for moving beyond the finite towards the infinite that might be transformed from geometrical figures to be created and their creator. Well, okay, I sort of am a bit more tolerant of this because, you know, you've got S2... 720 degrees inversion symmetry everywhere around us, yet no one can comprehend it. It's beyond human comprehension. So our science now has actually gone beyond. We can't pick up an object and say, look, an electron's like that. So it's interesting in different ways. It's the mechanism. So this is third order mechanism. His second order, third order, I still think his thinking is an interesting approach. Okay. In book two of Learned Ignorance, Cusanus deals with the created universe. The natural universe counts as limited or contracted maximum that is the image of the absolute maximum. Here Nicholas introduces another central metaphor to capture the relationship between God and creatures. The metaphor is the enfolding and unfolding, complico and explicitico. He expands the folding metaphor he inherited from the 12th century school of Chartres. While all beginnings are enfolded in undifferentiated oneness with the divine source, they are at the same time unfolding of the God in time and space. Insofar he is the unfolding, he, capital He, Nicholas writes, in all things he is which they are, just as an image of reality itself, veritas, image of reality itself, veritas, is present. The Neoplatonic terms, one must think of the unfolded universe we experience and all that is real in it as one enforced in the creator by whom it depends. God encompasses everything created in dialectical outflow and a return to God without any creatures ever being identified with the God on whom they depend. That one who remains both present to them and ever absent and beyond. What the unfolding and enfolding couple captures is the dynamic relationship between the divine original and the created image. So that's a way of thinking about the unthinkable. It's quite an interesting theme. The natural universe, then, is the whole or contracted maximum collectively constituted by many beings in space and time. Nicholas proposes quasi-anaxagorean slogan that each thing is in each thing, quod libet in quo libet, to emphasize that the individual beings or parts are no less contracted images of the whole created universe. Just, this is hard for you to get your mind about. Imagine reading this and summarizing it and trying to give it a podcast on this. This is why I've just gone and read this. Just as God is present to each creature that stands as a contracted image of the divine, so the universe as a macrocosm is presented to each creature or constitutive part of the microcosm. In that way, each natural thing is an image of the collective whole. But since the collectivity is made up of interrelated parts, each thing is also totality of its connections with everything else. Each thing is in each thing, because each is an image reflecting the oneness of the whole, and thus all other individuals that are interrelated parts of that whole. You can imagine sitting in a room and going, that was great. You can imagine the average people going, what? Nicholas also recognizes in Book 2 that the natural universe is characterized by change and motion. It's not static in time and space, but finite change and motion, ontologically speaking, are also matters of more or less to have no fixed maximum or minimum. This ontological relativity leads Cusanus to some remarkable conclusions about the Earth and the physical universe. Let's go! So this is, you know, let's go Copernicus and all this type of stuff. That, based on no empirical observations, but on metaphysical grounds. So let's pause here. How did we come up with magnetism? My understanding of magnetism, it was Immanuel Kant's views on Christianity, which led to the early magnetic experiments. So this is just mind-bending. The Earth is not fixed in space at some given point, because nothing is utterly at rest, nor can it be an exact physical centre of a natural universe, even if it seems nearer the centre than fixed stars. Because the universe is in motion without fixed centre or boundaries, none of the spheres of the Aristotelian or Ptolemaic world picture are exactly spherical. None of them, which is, you know, like, this is big news, because people said everything is exactly spherical, end of story, go away, just shut the door and just move that heckler away. None of them are at the exact centre of the atmosphere is no boundary. The universe is therefore infinite in the sense of a physically bounded. Cusanus thus shifts the typical medieval picture of the created universe towards later views, but ontological grounds. So he has actually jump started. He's up in the 20th century, you know, really 20th century view of the universe. He's clocked onto it 15th century, but by this bizarre path, which is as valid and equal to the mistaken view that people have. For Nicholas, the exact center and circumference of the created universe are to be found only in God. What we take to be the centre and outer limits depends on our viewpoint. What? In change, if we change perspective, say, to another planet, which might indeed be inhabited, and take that to be the centre, then the Earth might be at the zenith. In this way, we come to realise that what is taken as fixed or central can be altered to be moving and at a zenith, depending on the location and standpoint we pick in an unbounded universe. The reason Kunis writes is there's no exactness outside God, and the only God who is everywhere and nowhere is the universe's circumference and centre, which is pretty profound stuff. It's sort of coming at Einstein from a different way. In this way, learned ignorance recognises the natural universe itself as a contracted image of God, as a physical centre that has to be anywhere and a circumference that is nowhere. That's why Nicholas characterized the natural universe as a contracted maximum or a primitive finite infinite, while God remains the negative infinite or absolute maximum. This means that the universe merely lacks a set of physical bounds or limits, while God has no ontological limits in being all that can possibly be. See, mind-blowing. This enables the infinite universe as the whole constituted by all creatures to be an image of the divine oneness, but only in a contracted or attenuated fashion. Nowhere in the Christian is the Christian bearings on the learned ignorance.
Yes, son?
For Nicholas, the exact centre and circumference of the centre of the universe are to be found only in God, and what we take to be the centre and the outer limits depends on our viewpoint. I've done this before. The reason Cusan writes is that there's no exactness outside God, and only God is everywhere and nowhere. It's the universe's circumference as a centre. Very sort of interesting. So we've sort of arrived there, same point of view, without God. In this way, learned ignorance recognises that the natural universe itself, as a contracted image of God, has a physical centre that can be anywhere, and a circumference that is nowhere. That's why Nicholas characterized the natural universe as a contracted maximum of the primitive infinite, while God remains the negative infinite or absolute maximum. This means that the universe merely lacks a set of physical bounds or limits, while God has no ontological limits in being all that can possibly be. Nowhere in is the Christian bearing on the learned ignorance more obvious than Book 3, where Nicholas treats the God-man, Jesus Christ, as the third maximum, the maximum at once absolute and corrected. Once again, however, Cusanus uses the orthodox teaching of early Christian councils, such as Chalcedon, more as a background guard than a providing a straightforward Christology or text for exposition. He returns to the contrast between absolute God and contracted creatures that he used throughout Books 1 and 2 to interpret and contrast the relation between the infinite God and the finite creatures, even though there's no real proportion between them. God was construed as an absolute maximum and divine infinite oneness, while Nicholas viewed the natural universe as a contracted maximum whose unity in multiplicity and lack of physical limits reflected God's positively unlimited oneness. Weird, but he's sort of on track. Nicholas now entertains a third possibility, an anomalous joining of absolute and contracted in the God-man. He reviews, borrowing from Aristotle, the ordered universe of things belonging to natural types, genera and species. Okay, then modifies it by extending it to individuals, his idea of contraction and limitation. Individual specimens are all that exist, but not only are they contracted images of God's oneness, but also contracted images of types insofar as each more or less fulfills the possibilities of its nature. Okay, so that's, I suppose, interesting. So, there's the Aristotelian view of nature. A rock will fall down because it wants to be, it senses its nature to be earth. A cloud will rise up, not due to the forces of buoyancy and mass and gravitational effects. It's due to the fact that things have their nature to be up there. So it's limits in there. And it's interesting that he, in many times, the primitive scientific thoughts are in existence, bubbling into existence. So, mass bubbles into existence, but it's got sort of a theological origin. And I suppose what's interesting is that people read this, don't interpret it too much. Cusanus thereupon asks a hypothetical question. What would happen were a perfect specimen, an individual familiar of its type, to actually exist? So this is Platonic form. So what, you know, we are inexact copy theory of forms. In his language of maximality, it would be another maximum contracted to a unique individual of a given kind. But what would make such a maximum individual possible in a universe of more or less, or only its unique union with God, the absolute divine maximum, that is the source of every contracted reality, a union signaled in the traditional hypostatic union. The whole
of this maximal yet finite human nature is created and united with the absolute God, so that God remains transcendent yet inseparable from one human creature. In terms of enfolding and unfolding, this unique unfolding in the human being is the same time to reveal God enfolding in Jesus Christ. Jesus is the image of God, so utterly transparent as to remain opaque except to the eyes of faith. So this is, you know, he's a Christian person truly trying to work out what faith is doing with it all. Cusanus relies on the traditional microcosm-macrocosm trope to explain why human nature would be contracted nature best suited for union with the divine absolute. Yeah, okay. Human nature is created nature more common to the totality of beings, because the intimate status of human beings, being angels, and all other bodies, creatures, provide common ties in the whole range of created things. These ties are based on capacities as what is the highest of the lower and what is the lowest of the higher natures. So that it stands representative microcosm of a created macrocosm. The upshot is that the historical Jesus Christ is human in such a way as to be divine, and divine in such a way to be human. Maximum, at once contracted and absolute, the human image who simultaneously the divine original. Because the divine word is one with Jesus' human nature, the nature is perfect of its kind, and at the same time contracted and maximum. Learned ignorance may thus press Cusanus' metaphor and the ideas of limit in dealing with Jesus Christ, because the hypostatic oneness of the incarnate God will always elude full human understanding. Sort of like it's Aristotelian in that, with no measurement, no groundwork to work on, there's a long circular argument, but it's this one problem in that the fundamental aspect of Plato, of the philosophy of the forms, that we understand the form of, say, a chair, we know what the basis of it, and we can recognize it, so somewhere we must have seen the original perfect form. It's interesting. And then, well, if God is perfect, Jesus is perfect, you've got this whole problem. It's sort of like Jesus is something which cannot be computed by Platonic logic, yet he's used it. And so he's modern science has got out of this convulsion. We're not going too far to go through here. The third book relines the order of Christian metaphysics so that the God-man stands between God and the rest of his creation. For it's through mediation, the incarnate word, that creatures are made and creatures return to their source. In Book 1, Nicholas proposed that there is no proposition or measure between the finite and infinite that has enabled us to grasp the infinite God or even God's contracted image of the natural universe. This is what learned ignorance establishes for the and contributes to human wisdom. Which is a really interesting thing. He's actually got proto-sciences. It's sort of like you're chasing your tail all the time, sort of never really getting anywhere with scholasticism. However, you could probably argue that research based on publication is a form of scholasticism. This is what learned ignorance establishes from the contributions to, and contributes to human wisdom. Yet, the historic reality of Jesus Christ has a theoretical role to play in interpreting Nicholas's metaphysical vision. The Cusan Christ stands as more adequate norm and measure of theory and practice. Jesus Christ is the historical human image of the absolute one beyond our ken, and thus a paradigm that reveals our creaturely connection with the infinite God. Christ is the disclosure in time of what God is. In this way, learned ignorance points to Jesus Christ as the medium and the measure and mediator between finite and the infinite, and as well as the concrete norm for what human beings may become. There you go. The three books on learned ignorance thus represents a series of powerful proposals for reinterpreting Christian reality. Okay, and this is sort of quasi-scientific view. That is, not the actual scientific, but the actual the hypothesis. It's almost scientific. It's like a pre-form of scientific method. Throughout Nicholas's uses metaphors such as coincidences of opposite, absolute, contracted, enfolding, unfolded to relate to God and creation. His proposals are established by seeking out parallels between the infinite divine original and limited created images by drawing out the implications of the parallels. Now, this is what you could say is a theory and an example of the theorem. This book is neither medieval Aristotelian scholastic disputation or later Cartesian rationalism, but its own kind of Christian Neoplatonic speculation and treatise the philosophical imagination as much as it may frustrate any contemporary philosophical research for arguments or proofs. It is coherent of parallels that corresponds with the overall view of reality that creates Cusian metaphysics and Cusian metaphors in their persuasive power. So this is really interesting. I think you really need this. This is a stopgap between the medieval thinking and the Cartesian thinking. And Cartesian thinking, I think, is still valid today. So that ends this podcast. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.